When Dan Savage is asked about his professional qualifications as a sex advice columnist, he admits that he has none. But it's not like he lied his way into his job. A friend who was starting a weekly newspaper asked Savage what kind of advice column he thought the paper needed. Savage replied, sex, since people would risk anything to get their hands on a publication that covered sex. They agreed it should be different from other sex columns. It should be written by a man, by someone young, and gay. Savage fit the description. He wrote a prototype and then was surprised to find he had the job. His column, which is carried in weeklies across the country now, is called Savage Love. That's also the title of his new book, which is a collection of his columns. We're going to have an adult talk, which you may find inappropriate for children. Do you think, judging from the letters that you get from your readers, do you think that straight people and gay people see sex differently in any fundamental way? I don't mean in terms of like the mechanics of it, but just...
I think men and women see sex in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think gay men are men and lesbians are women and straight men and straight women are men and women. And when you have two gay men together, you get sort of male sexual dynamics cubed. And when you have two women together, you get female sexual dynamics cubed. Camille Paglia did some interesting writing about it in Sexual Persona, and I think she was right on the money. I think there are different hardwired genetic differences, different attitudes towards sex. We look at, when you look at the sexual behavior patterns of every other vertebrate mammal on the planet, practically, and there are repeated sort of dynamics in the male and female of all these different species, how we can look at all that and say, well, that doesn't apply to us, is beyond me. I think it does apply to us, and it plays out in same-sex relationships in sort of a almost a comically exaggerated manner. In a lot of opposite-sex relationships, female sexuality acts as a check on male sexuality. And in gay-sex relationships, for gay people, sometimes that female check is absent. And it can run riot. And it can be problematic in the lives of gay people. It's not the business of straight people to worry about it, but it can cause problems for gay men. And I address that honestly in my column. And then you see the same thing on the other side with too much reserve, I think, in some lesbian relationships.
You write that the idea some heterosexuals have that sex should be natural makes for some confusing thoughts. What do you mean there?
Straight people think that they shouldn't have to talk about sex to have sex. That since straight sex is obvious, you got tab A and you got slot B and you know exactly what to do, that there shouldn't have to be any conversation about likes and dislikes and preferences and anything else. And gay people don't have that attitude, because when you've got a tab or a slot and a slot, you have to have a conversation about what's going to happen. A lot of straight communication about sex ends with consent. Both people agree, and then sex happens, and there's no discussion because it's natural, and there shouldn't have to be a discussion. And that negatively impacts, I think, the quality of heterosexual sex a lot. With gay sex, once you say yes, that's the beginning. Once there's consent, then you talk about what you like, what he likes, or what she likes and she likes, and it's a long, drawn-out conversation so that you can find a way to sexually gratify each other that isn't, you know, dictated or wasn't taught to you in a high school sex ed class. And that takes communication, and straight people can sometimes skip the communication stage, or skip communication entirely, because straight sex is vaginal intercourse. What is there to talk about?
What are some of the things that you think people confess to you as a sex advice columnist that they wouldn't tell other people?
Anonymity is a powerful drug.
Yeah.
And people don't have to sign their letters to me, and I will answer them, and I'll put them in the paper. And there are things that I think that straight people can admit to me because of anonymity, and also because I'm a gay person. And whether they consciously or subconsciously realize it, I think a lot of straight people intuit that if I've given myself permission to be gay in this culture, if I've given myself permission to come out, and then I'm probably well positioned to give them permission to do whatever it is they want to do. You know, you see a lot more sexual expression in the gay community around fetish and kink and out there sexual practices and fun stuff that's not hurting anybody. Because, you know, if you've given yourself, as a boy, if you've given yourself permission to kiss boys, turning around and giving yourself permission to get a spanking isn't so scary. But for a straight person, you know, who never reached a point of conflict around sexual identity, that spanking is the scariest thing in the world because they never had to climb the mountain of, you know, rejecting an imposed sexual orientation. And I hear from, that's a lot of my mail, you know, may I, it, I call it my mother may I mail, and I put it in my mother may I file, where, you know, I want to dress up like the Queen of England and smear peanut butter on my butt and get a spanking. What should I do? And my answer is invariably, dress up like the Queen of England, smear peanut butter on your butt and get a spanking. Who cares? It doesn't hurt anybody except for you, and you want it, so it's not really a hurt, is it? And so permission is what half of my mail is. I'm granting absolution and permission. I feel a lot like a priest sometimes.
Now, what have you found some of the most typical sexual insecurities are?
Jumping back a little bit, am I normal? Is this normal? And invariably, it's people with abnormal desire that want to be reassured that it is normal. And people have to let go of that. And that's something that gay people let go of early, you know, in teenagers. That's when I let go of being normal. And straight people sometimes have, you know, what makes straight people better than gay people is that straight people are normal. So the straight person who is confronted with desires that are regarded by their friends or family as abnormal sometimes has a little identity crisis on their hands. And, you know, that's the other half of my mail. You know, half of it's mother may I, and the other half is this normal? They want some reassurance that it's okay.
Well, apparently, judging from your mail, a lot of people have these powerful sexual fantasies that involve some kind of abuse, like being spanked or, you know, some kind of sadomasochistic imagery that they're not at all comfortable with. They're not sure whether they should give in to the fantasy or fight it. I'm wondering if you've given a lot of thought to why so many people's sexual fantasies have to do with some kind of risk or pain or sense of, you know, degradation?
Because it's sexy. I don't know. Risk is sexy. And a large part of often what makes sex erotic is this feeling of risk.
But why do you think that's true?
Vulnerable.
I mean, you're just saying that as if, well, we all know that that's true. Why do you think that that's maybe true?
God, no one's ever quite asked me the question that way. I don't know why it's true, and I don't think maybe that... I wonder what value there is in questioning it, you know what I mean? These things turn me on, and I want to know why, but once you know why, what difference does it make? There's still going to be
the
things
that
turn you on.
I'll answer that, because I think this is particularly true for women. You know, at the same time that people are being much more open about their sexual fantasies, you know, you also have the women's movement, and women have, you know, really stood up and say that they refuse to be degraded by men or in a sexually degrading relationship. And at the same time, if they're having a fantasy that...
But it's not sexually degrading if you're play acting, if you're pretending to be degraded.
But at the very least, it could be confusing for somebody.
It can be confusing from the outside. It's not... I don't know anyone who engages in SM practices who's confused by it. I know people standing outside of it who may not understand it and feel at once titillated and repulsed can sometimes be confused by it because of what it looks like. But when you watch little kids play, you know, I always compare a grown-up S&M to cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians. It is play. I mean, I think there's a reason why folks in the leather SM fetish community, which is just a horrible thing to say, sounds so unsexy to say that. There's a reason why they call what they do, they call it play. And play is exciting, and it's fun, and it's these roles. And I don't think you can divorce power from sex. And I think it was one of the mistakes of the sort of the feminist movement in the early 80s, especially the lesbian feminist movement, was trying to strip power dynamics out of sex. Power makes sex sexy, and power is always there. Whether, you know, you're just rolling over on top of your partner forcefully, there's like this erotically charged expression of power in that, or if you're taking the power roles and exaggerating them with props and costumes and cages and masks and whatever, and then inhabiting them in this like ridiculously blown up performance, even then it's still I think it's the same thing as, you know, a back scratch or a, you know, a playful slap and tickle. It's just blown up, and I don't think you can divorce power from and pain from human sexuality. Look at the role that power and pain plays in the sexuality of lower animals, and you see it all over the place. You know,
you do. I mean, handcuffs.
The boy animals
and leather.
Not the handcuffs, but you'll see the boy animals beating up the boy animals for the right to mate with the girl animals. So this, it's not just a human thing where you see power and violence in humans in sexuality. It's just present, and we can't run away from it. Better we should we should approach it in a healthy way, which is to compartmentalize it. You know, the problem is when power dynamics are unspoken, or when they're unspoken, they can become abuse, or they can, you know. I would rather have my boyfriend slap me during sex for fun than slap me during an argument. And I think sometimes it's the same impulse that can cause the slap.
Do you think that sadomasochism has been entering the mainstream? In other words, that it's much less underground and practiced by many more people than...
Yes, I do. Uh-huh. I mean, there are these... there's in the state that I live in, there's these chain of sex shops, like for non-shameful sex shops for grown-ups. And you can buy restraints and handcuffs and stuff and little paddles and blindfolds. And certainly SM imagery has become much more mainstream. It was on LA Law like 8 years ago. Somebody was handcuffed to a bed. I mean, imagine that 20 years ago on television. The Republic would have collapsed. And I certainly think that people recognize that what's important is consent. Did you see the movie Thelma and Louise a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I had a big argument with a friend because if you remember the rape of Gina Davis in this one scene where she was put up on the hood of a car and raped, and then yay for Susan Sarandon came and shot the guy. Woohoo! That should happen every time someone's raped. And then later in the movie, Gina Davis had consensual sex with Brad Pitt. With Brad Pitt's character, and it looked the same. Brad Pitt's character, Gina Davis, was up on a dresser, but it was like the same position. It was the same sex, basically. And my friend thought that was terrible because it was referencing the earlier rape. It was, it was just like the rape. It wasn't beautiful. It wasn't bunnies and in a bed and rose petals and crap like that. But I thought it was a really powerful statement about what's important is consent. She wanted to have sex with Brad Pitt. Who wouldn't? She didn't want to have sex with that guy on the truck. So it didn't matter that it looked the same. What mattered was consent, and her character had consented.
My guest is Dan Savage. He writes the nationally syndicated sex advice column, Savage Love. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Savage, and he has a syndicated sex advice column called Savage Love, and Savage Love is also the name of his new book. You are from a Catholic background and went to a Catholic high school. I'm wondering if it was difficult for you to start writing about sex, writing very explicitly about sex in your column. If maybe you were very inhibited and had to get over that.
I was very inhibited when I was young because of my Catholic upbringing, I think. And then when I came out to my family, I sort of injected a conversation about sex into our family life that has, in my immediate family, that has been healthy. And so by the time I started writing the column, many years later, it was, I was used to having these sort of blunt conversations about sex with people I was related to. My family is not from the quiet, passive-aggressive Catholic tradition. We're from the loud, argumentative, let's have a drink Catholic tradition. So when I came out, it did initiate this like ongoing debate about human sexuality, and relatives would come to me and say, "So what do you do in bed? How do you do that?" You know, I went from feeling guilty and shameful to being really aggressive about saying, "This is how I do it. This is how it's done. And you get out of my face about it, or I'll give you more gory details." And it was sort of a self-defense mechanism to be that graphic. You think you can shame me by implying that I have that kind of sex? Well, let me tell you, this is how it works, and this is how it feels, and I dig it. So get out of my face. I would have those conversations with my uncles, who were, when I first came out, who were pretty homophobic, and now are totally over it. I think, my personal experience of interacting with my large extended Catholic family around my sexuality is that straight people are fascinated by gay sexuality. They want to know how we do it. And if we don't tell them, they make stuff up about gerbils. So we should tell them, and we should answer their questions. A lot of gay people react in horror when somebody says, "So what do you do in bed? How do you, isn't that gross? Won't that hurt you? Doesn't it hurt?" And gay people, get all offended and puffed up and say, "I'm not just who I have sex with, and I don't want to just be a sex." But then we don't answer straight people's most sort of burning questions about what makes us different. And I was always doing that with my family. So when I started writing the column and started writing about straight sex and the way straight people did it, it was sort of a natural extension of this 10-year-long conversation I'd had with my family.
Now, is it true that your family was in an archdiocese film about model Catholic life?
Yes. My family was in featured in a special that the Chicago Catholic Television Network did in the 70s. My dad was a Chicago cop, a homicide detective, who had never met a gay person before I came out who wasn't a murderer or a corpse. And he was a Catholic cop, and he was a Roman Catholic deacon in the first class of the permanent diaconate, which was this sort of priest shortage stopgap measure the church began engaging in about 20 years ago to get somebody up on the altar. And my mother was a lay minister, and I was in a seminary, and we were all confirmed, and we were the perfect Catholic family. And, you know, now a few abortions, a couple of divorces, and a gay son later, we're not the perfect Catholic family anymore, you know. And but they haven't contacted us about doing a Where Are They Now special, and I doubt that they will.
Sex is, it goes without saying, a very sexy subject. I wonder if you ever get tired writing about it.
I do, actually. And sometimes in the column, I will change the subject and write about something else. I've written movie reviews in the column, and sometimes I just write goofy nonsense in the column.
Because you have a headache?
Because I have a headache, exactly. Sometimes you just, yeah, you got to change the subject. I do a lot of other writing. I do pieces on This American Life on public radio, and I do a lot of writing for my home paper in Seattle, The Stranger, on politics and just stuff that has nothing to do with sex or gay sex or anything else. Or gay politics. And that other writing, I think, helps to keep me sane. People say, oh, you're sexually obsessed. You write this column. And I always say, well, it's a sex column, so of course I would appear to be sexually obsessed if all you ever read is my sex column. But, you know, I have long conversations into the night with my friends about Kosovo and NAFTA, but no one's there to see them, and I don't write a Balkans advice column. I write a sex advice column.
Well, Dan Savage, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Dan Savage writes the nationally syndicated sex advice column, Savage Love. His columns are collected in his new book, Savage Love.